Good afternoon, members. I convene the House Education Finance Committee for April 9th. Members, we're getting the minutes reprinted. There is a change to them, so we'll wait to do those. But I would like to kick it over to Co-Chair Kreisha to introduce his new members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, we have two new committee members. And so, Representative Gordon, if you'd start, and then we'll go to Representative Gander.
It's just on all the time.
Okay. All right. Well, that's
first day in committee, not first day of session.
I haven't worked with these microphones yet. Yeah, if they're on all the time, I better be careful what I say. I appreciate being added to the committee here, my name is Representative Jimmy Gordon at District 28A. That's Isani, Cambridge, Braham area, I guess that's about it.
My name is Representative Steve Gander from 1B, which is East Grand Forks, Polk County, Norman County, Red Lake County, a little bit of Clay. Happy to be serving on this committee. I'm definitely on a learning curve, so you all can educate us as we go, and just honored to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And as a time-honored tradition for all of our members, we've all done this. Most embarrassing moment and how it applies to education finance.
Wow.
No, I'm just kidding. Welcome to the committee.
We do have time to kill. No, welcome, Representative Gordon and Representative Gander. And Representative Gordon, you are in a committee room where you have to turn the mics on usually, so don't feel bad. This is just a unique one. The mute button's right on the corner there in case you do want to say something that you don't want the mics to pick up. Otherwise, they're pretty sensitive. With that, members, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Sensenmayer. Welcome to your committee. Would you like to move House File 3119 before us for discussion and to be laid over for our possible inclusion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 3119, and I do have an author's amendment.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Mura, would you like to briefly explain your author's amendment, and then we'll move to adoption?
Yeah, so the original bill is a language around teacher salary, and what I am proposing in the author's amendment is to add language that actually comes from a bill by Representative Ryer, HF2904, which is called the EGIT bill. This is creating a educator health insurance pool and also instructing the LBO to collect some data around current health insurance for district employees so that we can start the process of creating the health insurance pool. So this, I would like to add this amendment, and this will get the bill in the shape that I would like.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmayer. And members, this is the shape that the author would like to have it before us, just to have this discussion. Portions of the EGIT bill, particularly around the data collection, was already heard in taxes. Chair Davids had wanted to hear it there. So I'd like to move to any questions on the A3. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Joachim. And yes, as the custom, we always try to get the bills and the author they like. I would support moving the author's amendment.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha. With that, members, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The A3 is adopted. All right. Representative Sensenmayer, go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Joachim, Chair Kreisha, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present the amended House File 3119. Like many of you, I believe that the people in our school buildings are the biggest levers of change in our education system. If we want to change learning outcomes for kids, we have to make sure that the educators that work with our kids are compensated fairly. And right now, Minnesota teachers, education support staff, social workers, custodians, food service workers, and other educators are not paid what they deserve. This bill begins to fix that. It addresses both sides of the compensation equation. What educators take home in their paycheck, and what they pay to keep themselves and their families healthy. I want to talk about each of these components. On the pay, the evidence is clear and it is depressing. The researchers at the Economic Policy Institute analyzed wage data and found that Minnesota teachers take home 33% less per week than their peers with similar levels of education in other fields. That is the fourth worst penalty in the nation. Our state is asking people who hold college degrees and often master's degrees to accept a roughly one-third pay cut in their weekly paycheck in exchange for the privilege of educating Minnesota's children. This is a signal sent every payday that this profession is valued less than others. The gap begins at the very start of one's teaching career. In 2023, researchers at the University of Minnesota's Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity examined state data and found that among teachers in their first 5 years, 58% earn less than half the basic cost of living in their area. That was before the inflation of 2023 and 2024 made this even worse. We are asking people who have spent years earning college and graduate degrees to spend the first decade of their careers unable to pay their bills, often without a second job. While the data for other kinds of educators is only anecdotal, it tells the same story. The current level of pay and benefits in Minnesota schools is not a tool for recruitment, it is actually a deterrence. The teaching profession is responding accordingly. RAND Corporation publishes an annual survey of the American teaching workforce. Last year's edition found that low pay and long working hours are the top two reasons teachers give for considering leaving their jobs. And this is why, in Minnesota, we have an educator shortage. According to the state's own 2025 Teacher Supply and Demand Report, more than 36% of Minnesota's licensed teachers are not currently teaching in a public school classroom, usually because they have quit. Nearly a third of teachers leave within their first 5 years. And when asked why, school after school pointed to the same two answers, salary and the cost of benefit. The pay provisions of this bill address this directly. Beginning in the 26-27 school year, the bill establishes minimum base salaries for licensed teachers. A teacher without a master's degree would earn at least $60,000. A teacher with a master's degree would earn at least $80,000. A teacher with a master's degree and at least 10 years of experience would earn at least $100,000. The state would provide aid to districts to meet these thresholds. This is not an unfunded mandate on local schools. And the thresholds will be indexed to inflation so they don't erode the moment that we pass them. Now I want to talk about the healthcare piece, because as I started working on this bill around salaries, it became really apparent that we can't only address the salary component. We have to address healthcare as well. As we know, for most working people, health insurance is their single most important benefit. It determines whether they can afford to get sick, whether their family can see a doctor. And right now, Minnesota school employees are caught in a health insurance system that is failing them badly. This is what happened to some districts across our state. According to Education Minnesota, premiums in Mankato jumped 30% in a single year. In Lyle, they jumped 34%. In New Ulm, 54%. In Belgrade, Bruton, El Rosa, the proposed increase was 49%. These are not anomalies. This is what happens when small insurance pools have just a few people that have to go to the hospital. One serious claim in a small district and every employee pays for it, the next open enrollment. And on the other side of that negotiating table, last year United Health Group paid its CEO $26 million and returned $16 billion to its stakeholders. The CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota received a 34% raise, taking home $4.3 million, while passing costs on to our school district and our educators. We are giving money to school districts, and instead of that money going to our students, it is going to the pockets of health insurance companies. The problem is structural. Minnesota has more than 300 school districts, each negotiating separately, each a small buyer in a market that rewards large ones. The giant insurance companies know this, and educators pay for it every year in higher premiums, crushing deductibles, and narrowing coverage. The amended bill addresses this in two steps. The first step is to gather information. Before the legislature can build a fiscally credible statewide pool of all school employees, we need to know exactly what school districts are paying on health insurance today. And I think as we will go through the runs later with Mr. Strom, right now we have trouble kind of gathering all the data we need about health insurance. The insurance report provision of this bill requires every school district and charter school to complete an annual health insurance survey covering premiums, administrative fees, broker commissions, and plan designs. The Legislative Budget Office will compile and publish the results, and that information will become the foundation of a trustworthy fiscal note for our next step. The second part is the goal. The Educator Group Insurance Program, known as EGIP, would create a statewide health insurance pool for all public school employees. This pool would cover more than 100,000 employees plus their dependents. And that number matters for two reasons. First, a pool of 100,000 people spreads risk across a much larger group. When risk is spread widely, a bad year for one district doesn't spike premiums for everyone. Costs become more stable, budgets become more predictable. School employees stop dreading that open enrollment letter. Second, 100,000 people have bargaining power that 330 separate school districts do not. Right now, Minnesota school employees negotiate health coverage district by district in hundreds of small pools, each one facing the same giant profitable insurance company by themselves. EGIC can change that equation. It puts educators on the other side of the table as a unified block, large enough to demand better rates, better coverage, and better terms. That is how state employees do it, and that is how Minnesota school employees should do it too. Members of this committee, the educators in your districts are not asking for special treatment. They are asking to be compensated fairly for skilled professional work, with wages that reflect their education and their experience, and with health coverage that does not consume an ever larger portion of their paycheck that is already too small. If you dedicate your career to educating Minnesota's children, this state and its school district should meet you with compensation that respects that choice. This bill can make that commitment, and I ask for your support. And now I would like to turn it over to one of my testifiers, Nineveh Caligari from the Teacher Salary Project, who will give a short presentation about the national context for the work around teacher salaries and where Minnesota fits in compared to other states.
I believe Nineveh Caligari is remote, so if you could come online, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Hello, I'm Nineveh Caligari.
Go ahead.
Does this work? Great. Thank you so much for inviting our team. Everyone is listening on YouTube, and we couldn't be more proud to be here. We started 22 years ago listening to teachers' stories about compensation. One of the first stories I heard was a teacher housekeeping, and I thought, wow, this is worse than I thought, a woman with a master's degree holding a second job. We wrote a book that was a New York Times bestseller. We then produced a film that was screened all over the country, and then ultimately we dropped legislation in Congress. And we had bipartisan support to create a minimum salary of $60,000 around the nation. What happened that's even more important is that 19 states created legislation at the state level, and Minnesota's legislation that is being introduced is better than the legislation that we wrote because of the $80,000 and the $100,000 benchmarks. So I just want to share a few slides around some of the context around the nation and also say thank you for having us here today and giving us a chance to share this research. So teacher pay would, something is not right. Slideshow. Teacher pay would be at $120,000 if teacher pay had kept pace with per pupil spending. What happened was people assumed that it was women's work and it was secondary income, and it wasn't important to keep that pay professional. So we've let it slip. Other places don't let it slip. For example, in Finland, legislators like yourselves tie teacher pay to accountants' pay because they know how valuable the work is and they didn't want the prestige to slip. In our country, as was just mentioned, teachers take a 27% pay cut as compared to other college-educated people, and we have completely normalized not just housekeeping but bartending and Uber. So if you can imagine doing a full day's work at the legislature and then going and driving Uber at night, it's untenable and it's unacceptable, and very few teachers say that they're living comfortably on their income. So around the nation, what happens is that teachers do their best work and they get burnt out and they quietly leave. So we're trying to transform the situation, but 86% of districts around the nation are experiencing teacher shortages. Every single state in the nation is struggling to find math, science, and special ed teachers. So there are not only classrooms that are empty, but the other piece of the dynamic is that there are classrooms with underqualified people, which you know impacts turnover and morale and learning outcomes dramatically. Mm-hmm. So one thing that saddens us incredibly is that 62% of American parents are imploring their college-age children to not teach. We have never seen this kind of number in our lifetime. The number one reason that these parents are saying that they don't want their children to teach is because of the salary. So this is why Minnesota is leading the charge, and this is so cutting edge because this is changeable. Student absenteeism rates are higher in our nation than they have ever been in our lifetimes, and the learning outcomes reflect that. And students who miss a lot of school are also the same students who eventually drop out. It's incredibly expensive and devastating. So Minnesota, you know these numbers, so we won't linger here, but you know that it's pretty tough. Teachers struggle in Minnesota. They have a 33% pay cut. There's 56,000 of them, and they deserve to be treated professionally. And then there's 10% who are underqualified, which is concerning, and then their vacancies. So you know all of this. Minnesota, we're grateful. Minnesota's already tackling this shortage at different angles, and this legislation takes it even further and is leading the nation. This is why we are so honored to be here. I want to shed some light also on a story very briefly that when you do transform the pay, how things come together in a way that's profound and meaningful. So there's a district in Everett, Washington, and they had their starting pay at $48,000, and they had the enormous pay scale where it would take over 20 years to get to a medium income, and they were meandering along with the low learning results and low morale and turnover. They decided in a short amount of time to have a searing focus on teacher pay. So the higher levels of pay get up to $160,000. Now they have virtually no turnover. For every kindergarten position, they get 60 applicants. So this community in Washington gets to pick the teachers that they think are going to be the very best matches. And now, of course, their learning results have increased in double digits. And most importantly, the learning results for the kids from vulnerable backgrounds have also increased. So we know kids from vulnerable backgrounds can do algebra. We just have to make sure to get them a great teacher so that can happen. The other powerful piece that I think as a legislator is incredibly exciting is that what they found is when they spent money on teacher pay, teachers went and spent money at movie theaters, at restaurants, at grocery stores, at the orthodontist office. So teachers are putting that money back, and they saw this incredible infusion of money in the local community. So we are proud to be in Minnesota today. We thank you for inviting us here, and we know that when Minnesota pays teachers professionally, these wonderful outcomes can happen, and you can repair that pipeline. We have found that when we ask college students in our nation if they want to teach, 4% of college students say they want to teach. When you ask that same group of college students, if they were to earn a six-figure salary like Minnesota is offering, if they could get to $100,000, would they then want to teach? And the response is up to 60%. So college students have just had somebody find the light in them, and they would like to be that person to find the light in another person. So you can attract the best talent. They're waiting for us to professionalize this incredibly important job. And I just want to say that everyone at the Teacher Salary Project, we're happy to come back, bring research. We're happy to do anything that is helpful to you. And we always like to say that we should pay teachers what we think our future is worth. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for your testimony. And I believe that we'll be sending out us the slides so that we can send them out to committee members. And thank you, Representative Sensenmayer, for having somebody present the facts. I resonate with the fact. My husband's taught for over 30 years. His dream was always to have one of our children be a teacher and that they could teach in the same school building together. And when our son said he wanted to be a teacher, my husband tried to talk him out of it. So that is happening. With that, I think we'll go to the following testifiers that have signed up. We have Dr. Elena Bailey from the Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board, and she is remote. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Chair Joachim, Chair Krisha, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Dr. Elena Bailey, and I'm the Executive Director of HELSBE. As the agency responsible for licensing and supporting 110,000 teachers across the state of Minnesota, our board has thought significantly about the ways we can better recruit and retain high-quality educators. Unsurprisingly, teacher compensation has been a key component of these conversations. Research has shown that the teacher pay gap, which is the weekly wage discrepancy between what teachers earn and what similarly educated professionals earn, is over 31% here in Minnesota. This is higher than both the national average and the pay gaps in neighboring states. In fact, we ranked 44th in the nation for our teacher pay gap. In 2024, the legislature created the Teacher and Paraprofessional Compensation Workgroup with the purpose of making recommendations to the legislature. Facilitating that group, I heard firsthand from educators, administrators, and HR professionals that change is needed. Ultimately, that group made four key recommendations. First, a $60,000 minimum pay for teachers, $80,000 for teachers with a master's, a $25 per hour minimum pay for school employees with hours that guarantee benefits, a statewide health care program for educators that mirrors the Minnesota State Employee Group Insurance Plan, otherwise known as CGIP, and the ability to retire at 60. Like the members of the compensation work group, Pelsby believes Minnesota's teachers deserve better. They deserve compensation that reflects the great respect many of us hold for the profession. By establishing a minimum teacher salary, this bill strides towards recognizing the honorable work our teachers do to serve a Minnesota student. One recommendation Pelsby has to ensure this bill can be properly implemented is a change to the reporting requirement in Section 2. Pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 122A.18, Pelsby has authority to collect non-licensed staff data on behalf of the Department of Education, but it's MDE that manages the data. So we recommend this section be amended to have MDE provide the report on non-licensed staff hours and wages. Before I close, I'd like to speak briefly to the amendment, which addresses the compensation workers' recommendation regarding benefits. Between 2018 and 2023, the cost of health care insurance for teachers rose by 14%. Meanwhile, teacher salaries only rose by about 10%. For districts, their cost of coverage has risen by 12 or 13%, and these costs are only getting higher. The current model for health insurance and education isn't working for teachers or districts. The compensation work group proposed a solution: create a new model that mirrors the Minnesota State Employee Group Insurance Plan, or CGIP. And HF 3119 takes up this recommendation and would significantly reduce educators' financial burdens by lowering healthcare premiums. Pelsby strongly supports this bill and thanks Representative Sensenbrenner for advocating for our teachers. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bailey. And I forgot the ending of the story. Our son is a teacher, fourth generation on both sides, so it did have a happy ending. But with that, Aaron Rosenthal is up next, and then Sarah Burt on deck. So you could both come out to the table if you'd like. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joachim, Co-Chair Kreisha, members of the committee. I'm Aaron Rosenthal. I'm the research director for North Star Policy Action, a think tank dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3119. Much of the testimony today has already demonstrated the considerable issues with educator compensation in the state. I want to bring attention to a particular aspect of that issue that too often receives less attention: pay and benefits for education support professionals, or ESPs. ESPs include the paraprofessionals who ensure students with disabilities get the support they need, and the food service workers who make sure no child goes hungry during the school day. There are 42,000 K-12 ESPs in Minnesota, and contrary to common myths, they are not a marginal or part-time workforce. The majority of ESPs in Minnesota work 40 or more hours a week, and 80% work over 30 hours. Despite these full-time hours, 68% of ESPs in Minneapolis report working a second job, reflecting the low pay these workers receive. The numbers bear this reality out. 90% of ESPs nationwide report that low pay is a concern, and 30% face problems affording the basics needed to live, including food. In Minnesota, nearly one in three ESPs earn less than $25,000 a year, meaning they earn a poverty wage. On average, K-12 ESPs in Minnesota earn $12,000 less than their counterparts in higher education, demonstrating that we have a particular problem in our K-12 system. Unfortunately, this problem is bad and getting worse. After adjusting for inflation, Minnesota ESPs today make $3,000 less than they did in 2021. That is an unsustainable trend. Let me be direct. Setting a $25 minimum wage, as House File 3119 does, still means ESPs will be paid below a living wage if they're in a two-worker, two-child household. But creating this floor is an essential step, an overdue step, in reversing declining pay. The healthcare picture is just as troubling. Nationally, 1 in 10 ESPs rely on Medicaid for coverage, and 3 in 10 have problems covering medical expenses, including 1/4 who struggle to afford their premiums. This status quo is particularly alarming given looming Medicaid cuts and the historically large premium increases hitting school districts across the state, as have already been mentioned. That is precisely why it is so important that ESPs be explicitly included in any statewide educator health pool, as 3119 provides. In taking steps to improve wages and benefits for ESPs, House File 3119 would simply allow Minnesota to catch up with many other states. New Mexico, in 2023, a state with a lower cost of living than ours, enacted a $25 minimum wage for school employees. Multiple states have already created statewide educator health pools that include ESPs. Progress in ESP treatment is necessary, as is apparent, based on actions taken elsewhere. One final point. Finding detailed wage and benefits information for hourly school workers in Minnesota for this testimony was challenging, to say the least. Beyond statewide wage averages and national survey results, the data does not exist in a systematic way. That gap speaks directly to the importance of the ESP study called for in House File 3119 and should remind us that it is difficult to comprehensively address a problem that we cannot fully see. I want to close with something I think is worth saying plainly. Passing these bills is not just about doing right by ESPs in Minnesota who dedicate their lives to helping our young people, though we should want to do that. It is also about the students who depend on ESPs every single day, students who need clean and hygienic schools, students who need a nurse when they're sick, and a bus driver who can get them to school safely. How can we allow people with whom we entrust so much responsibility to be compensated so poorly? When we fail to treat these workers with basic dignity, our kids pay the price. Minnesota's future depends on getting this right. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Sarah Burt, and then on deck is John Wolhopter, which you'll have to pronounce that for me. I'm sorry. Go ahead. State your name for the record and proceed.
Co-chairs Joachim and Krisha and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Burt, a lobbyist for Education Minnesota. I'm here to tell you about the in the A3, it contains House File 2904, a bill that creates a statewide large health insurance pool for all public school employees. The pool, named the Educator Group Insurance Program, or EGIP, would provide increased stability across the state for districts small and large. Teachers, paraprofessionals, custodians, and other school employees would all be eligible for the pool. The creation of the EGIP pool would create increased stability and predictability by spreading risk over a larger group. Minnesota Management and Budget would oversee the program, similarly to how they oversee CGIP, the State Employees Group Insurance Program. Importantly, the EGIP program will be modeled after that state program using the same tiered cost level design. This mirroring in design and the additional size that EGIP brings will provide the state with additional leverage and negotiating power when dealing with health insurance carriers and providers. Additionally, a labor management committee will exist to give input and be a part of future decision-making progress in the plan design. One of the most important aspects of the large pool would be the efficiency and savings created by lowering administrative costs for every district, eliminating redundancies and duplications of processes in districts, as well as the elimination of unnecessary service layers. Currently, school districts all across the state are paying for and allocating resources to search, compare, implement, and yet still struggle with health insurance benefits. The time of school personnel and money being spent on services like brokers would be much better used as support for educators and our students in order for them to succeed. A funding investment is needed for the bill. However, I want to be clear, the language in Section 15 of the A3, lines 10.22 to 11.4, creates an aid stream for districts where any new costs associated with the requirements in this bill will be funded through the Department of Education. Districts would be funded the difference between their current premium costs and any new costs incurred upon the passage of this bill. Minimum employer contribution levels for the premium are set by this bill as well, which once again are covered by the EGIP aid stream in Section 15 of the amendment. This investment would make both quality and affordable health insurance a possibility for educators across the state and provide districts with one of the recruitment and retention tools they desperately need. And the investment would further pay off as the statewide program cost savings in the years to come are achieved. Thank you for your time today, and I ask you for your support of House File 3119 as amended.
Thank you. Next up is John Wohlhopter and then Brianna Lawrence on deck. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Greeting, co-chairs Joachim and Kresha. My name is John Wohlhopter, and I am the president of Anokanapen Education Minnesota, the union representing the teachers and licensed staff in the largest school district in Minnesota. The educators and the community members of Anokanapen Schools started 2026 facing the uncertainty of a possible strike. This situation was a symptom of the increasingly difficult choices teachers and others working in education face when trying to negotiate a contract. Do we prioritize an increase in salary that may or may not keep up with inflation? Is it more important to keep health insurance premiums affordable? It is simply becoming impossible to do both. A typical raise for educators is often around 2%. This amounts to a $1,000 to $2,000 increase in salary for an entire year. When insurance costs are increasing $400 to $700 per month for families, educators are destined to continue to fall behind. In Anokahennepin, we are currently self-insured. In the past, this structure has provided flexibility in coverage while also managing costs. Our pool was considered large enough to shield us from the worst of cost increases. That is no longer the case. This school year, our premiums increased 22%. For next year, we will have another double-digit percentage increase. That is unsustainable for both employees and the district. Employee groups in Anokanapen are trading higher deductibles and copays for slightly reduced premium increases to try and mitigate that cost. We are paying more for less coverage. This arrangement continues to put the onus of cost increases on the budgets of individual educators. The results make many educators question whether a career serving the students of Anokahennepin is one that will enable them to support their own families. Right now, hundreds of individual districts across the state are faced with a precarious situation when they go out to find their next health insurance bid. Each one of those districts is one bad claims year from their carefully constructed plans falling apart. The landscape now is far different than it was 14 years ago when a statewide health insurance pool for districts was last considered. At that time, costs seemed manageable. Self-insured districts advocated that the flexibility of their plans meant they could maintain affordable coverage. That is no longer the case. When Anokahennepin, a self-insured district with an $86 million budget for health insurance, can't weather a series of high claims, it's clear we need a new system. The employees in Anokahennepin and districts across the state need action. We support combining our resources and efforts on a large scale. A statewide plan would eliminate the duplication of work currently being done in hundreds of districts across the state. It would leverage the power of over 100,000 education staff to better negotiate with insurance companies. Yesterday, an elementary teacher shared with me how she had moved onto her spouse's insurance due to how expensive coverage to the district had become. She is not alone. Already this year, 900 dependents and individuals have left our district plan. Given the additional increases we're expecting for next year, this number will only increase. These individuals had other options available to them, but that may not be the case in the future. If a career in education cannot support the hopes and dreams of educators, educators cannot effectively support the hopes and dreams of our students. I urge you to support House File 3119. Thank you. As amended.
Thank you. Next up is Brianna Lawrence, and then if Mishka Nation can also join the table, that'd be great. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Brianna Lawrence. Good afternoon. My name is Brianna Lawrence, and I am a 712 public school counselor in rural Minnesota. My husband, Devin, is a public high school music teacher. Together, we have given nearly a decade of service to public education in the same district. We're early in our careers. We have done everything right by the standards we are given. We pursued meaningful, stable work. We joined our union. We enrolled in health plans available to us. We maxed out our contributions to health savings accounts. We waited 8 years before trying to have a family because we were responsibly saving. 2 years ago, we lost our first child. There are no words that make this experience reasonable. It's every parent's nightmare. Alongside the grief came significant medical bills, the kind that don't stop just because you're grieving, that kind that drained nearly everything that I had in my HSA, which was $11,000. Now we're expecting our daughter, our rainbow baby, in June. This pregnancy has already been medically complicated. By February, I had already met my $3,400 deductible while paying monthly premiums of $450. Just last week, I was only $60 away from my $5,100 out-of-pocket maximum. This should be a time of cautious hope. Instead, Devin and I are sitting at our kitchen table trying to figure out how much debt we're going to take on just simply to have a child. Right now, my husband and I pay $686 in monthly healthcare premiums. The moment we add our baby, that number changes drastically. The most inexpensive no HSA family plan for our district would cost us $2,232 per month. A high deductible family plan, which is our most realistic option, would cost $1,464 per month with a completely new $7,000 deductible and $10,000 out-of-pocket maximum. There is no version of this where the numbers make sense for a young family without substantial savings. This June, with the addition of our daughter, we will start paying nearly $800 more per month in premiums, while also preparing to absorb up to $15,000 out of pocket this year alone by December. And it starts over in January. We have already paid thousands in medical costs tied to the death of our first child. We're not coming into this with reserves. We're coming into it having already been financially and emotionally depleted by loss. We're two public educators. My husband regularly works a conservative 10 hours a workday to build a music program that serves as a lifeline for students. He's been told more than once that his classroom is the reason some students are still alive. It is not possible with that kind of schedule to regularly work a second job on top of that, in case anyone thinks that's part of the solution. My team and I, we serve over 1,000 students at our rural public school. As a school counselor, I sit with students in crisis. I help them navigate anxiety, depression, and at times whether or not they believe their life has value. Devin and I love this work. We believe in it. We're good at it. And we know Minnesota values highly qualified educators, but we cannot rationally defend staying in public education if it means accepting financial conditions that are going to put our own family at risk. Nearly 40 to 50% of teachers leave the profession within 5 years, and that statistic is often discussed in terms of burnout, workload, pay. What's not talked about is the role that unsustainable benefits and family-related health insurance costs play in that decision. This is how it happens. Not all at once, but in moments like this when two committed educators who love their jobs sit down and realize starting a family could push them into financial ruin. Our wages are public domain. After 7 years in the district, Devin earns $54,000. With my master's degree and 3 years in the district, I earn $56,000. The wage increase in House File 3119, as amended, would help our family immensely. To get his teaching degree, my husband has over $70,000 in student loans. I have $40,000 in student loans. The Student Loan Save repayment program just ended, meaning we now need to start making new large monthly payments on our student loans. Our budget per month has to adjust drastically. With two incomes, we won't pocket any of our wages. In fact, we're looking at losing $112 per paycheck for both of us. That doesn't even include groceries, gas, unexpected expenses. We're at a point where, despite loving our district, our colleagues, and our students, that we're being forced to consider leaving public education entirely, not because we want to, because we cannot justify the financial risk. Minnesota has an opportunity to address this. Health insurance reform for educators is not theoretical, it is immediate, it is personal, and it's directly tied to whether young educators like us can build families while staying in the profession that they love. We want to stay. I know our students are watching this right now. We want to stay. We want to raise our daughter in the community we serve, and we want to continue showing up for all of the students who rely on us. But wanting to stay is no longer enough. We need a system that makes it possible, and one health insurance pool for all educators is that solution. Please support House File 3119 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your personal story and giving us a glimpse in your life as a teacher. Next up, we have Mishka Nation and then Nellie McLean Brown, and then Kevin Elton on deck.
Hello, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3119. My name is Makisha Nation, and I serve as the Executive Director for Teach for America in the Twin Cities, a role that I've been honored to hold since 2017. Teach for America is a teacher preparation and leadership development program, and since 2009, we've been partnered with schools and communities across Minnesota to recruit, train, and develop high-impact educators in the communities where they're most needed. Across the Twin Cities and throughout Minnesota, we continue to see lasting effects of interrupted learning, particularly in foundational milestones like third grade reading and eighth grade math. These are not just academic benchmarks. These are predictors of long-term success, including high school graduation, post-secondary readiness, and access to family-sustaining careers and economic mobility. At the same time, we know through research and lived experiences that teachers are the most important in-school factor driving student experiences, student learning, student growth, and academic achievement. And yet, many of our educators are leaving the profession, not because they lack commitment, but because they do not feel adequately valued, supported, and compensated. This is a difficult tension that we need to all work together to address and to develop innovative solutions. Low teacher pay continues to be one of the most significant barriers to recruiting and retaining strong educators. And national data reflects what we see locally, a substantial portion of teachers exit the profession due to compensation and lack of support. In a recent Teacher Salary Project survey, more than 1,000 educators, including many recognized for excellence, only 1 in 5 reported that their current salary was sufficient to keep them in the classroom long term. When we underinvest in educators, we create instability in our schools. And that instability ultimately disrupts learning, it weakens instructional continuity, and it ultimately makes it more difficult for students to meet critical milestones that set them on a path towards long-term success. House File 3119 represents a meaningful step in addressing this challenge. It signals to current and future educators that Minnesota is serious about investing in instructional excellence and building a strong and sustainable education workforce. If we are committed truly to ensuring that every child is on a track to read proficiently by the third grade and to succeed with math by eighth grade and to graduate and be able to pursue post-secondary options, including college and their career and their life, then we have to be committed to compensating and supporting the educators that make those outcomes possible. I urge you to support House File 3119 as part of a broader commitment to strengthening our education pipeline, stabilizing our schools, and driving measurable outcomes for students across our state. Thank you for your time, for your leadership, and your continued commitment to make sure more children and communities in Minnesota learn, lead, and thrive.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Natalie McLean-Brown, and then Kevin Elton on deck.
Good afternoon. My name is Natalie McLean-Brown, and I'm here to support House File 3119 as amended. I'm a teacher at Green Central and Sullivan STEAM in Minneapolis. I've been teaching for over 10 years and have a master's in education. After healthcare taxes and other deductions, my take-home income in 2025 was less than $37,000. Ever since I became a mother, I've struggled to afford the basic necessities for my family. The family healthcare coverage for teachers is extremely unaffordable. The teacher family healthcare plan for 2026 costs $13,532 for just the premiums. The out-of-pocket maximum is $7,000. This means teachers will spend more than $20,000 each year until services are fully covered. On the teacher family plan, about 50% of my take-home income has gone to pay for healthcare coverage. This is too high a price to pay for a basic human need. In 2018, I paid about $5,000 for my daughter's birth, which was pretty average with little medical intervention. When my son was born in 2021, I had an emergency home birth because he arrived earlier than expected. He was born at 4:30 a.m. in my house. We called 911 and had an ambulance ready if needed. Once we knew he was healthy and I was okay, we decided to drive ourselves because we didn't know if we could afford the ambulance. We spent one night in the hospital and we were charged over $2,000. I also didn't put this in my script, but I wanted to add that I also had a miscarriage for my first pregnancy, and I was actually out of the country when this happened, and I was so relieved because I was in a place where they paid for my medical care. So I think about that experience and how traumatic it was, and the one part of it was that I didn't have to pay thousands of dollars to get the basic care I needed. Each year, the cost for premiums, copays, medications, and out-of-pocket expenses totals to thousands of dollars. In 2025, I spent over $17,000 on healthcare costs for my family. The lack of affordable healthcare has instilled a fear in me that follows me every time my child gets ill. When my son was three, we took him to an in-network ER in the middle of the night because he was having trouble breathing. They gave him a COVID RSV test and checked his vitals. The nurse offered to give him a dose of Tylenol, and I said no. I worried it might cost hundreds of dollars. We later received a bill for $1,100 for this 90-minute visit. Healthcare costs are rising every year and will continue to do so unless we make this necessary change. Passing House File 3119 as amended would ease so much of the stress that my family experiences on a day-to-day basis. I have been a teacher in Minneapolis for over 10 years, and I love my job. But ever since I started paying for family coverage, I've considered leaving to find a job that has better health benefits and a better salary. I struggle with the financial stress that the lack of affordable health care creates. An increase in salary and affordable health benefits would improve all teachers' quality of life and would support teacher retention. We need a stable and skilled teacher workforce to nurture our children and their future. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you, Natalie, for your testimony. Next up is Kevin Elton, and on deck is Akilah Roberson.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Elton. I'm a student success coach at Sibley East Middle and High School and serve as president of our local Education Minnesota group. Our district recently went through the healthcare bidding process. The medical needs of our staff are not unusual. They include cancer treatments, joint repairs, hospitalizations due to illness, and childbirth. All are essential to living a meaningful and healthy life. However, due to these costs, we received only three qualifying insurance bids, with four companies declining to offer coverage. The best offer we received resulted in a 35% increase in group premiums. For my family, that means paying an additional $6,000 per year. Do any of you have $500 per month you could cut from your family budget? I do not, and I am 18 years in with a master's degree and a principal license. For early career teachers supporting a family, premiums now consume 25% of their income. In addition to these premiums, we also face significant deductibles. If an early career family reaches their deductible maximum, their total out-of-pocket medical costs would exceed 40% of their income. The numbers are worse for our support staff. For support staff, a family plan is impossible, as it would consume 100% of their income and still require additional out-of-pocket expenses. I have colleagues already avoiding preventative care due to medical costs. Now, our staff will be forced to make additional sacrifices. Educators should not have to choose between their health, their families, and their financial future. I ask you to support HF 3119 as amended. This bill both raises educator salaries and creates a statewide health insurance pool, one large enough to foster real competition among the insurance providers and allow educators to focus on students instead of second or third jobs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, we have Akilah Roberson, Lori Goff, and then Christine Scott. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair, and committee members, I am Dr. Akilah Roberson, Policy Director at Education Evolving. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 3119. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? We've learned that quiet isn't always peace, and the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice. Amanda Gorman's poetic reflection, "The Hill We Climb," ignites a perspective drenched in hope that welcomes accountability, assumes responsibility, and that is willing to normalize a culture of collaboration. And within the context of education, these are the very elements needed to curate learning environments where the brilliance of every student can be cultivated. And who has this terrific responsibility? Our teachers, educators, but currently without the pay that reflects the weight of this assignment. House File 3119 is a hopeful step in the right direction of taking accountability and responsibility towards implementing rightful compensation for those in the teaching profession. Our teachers deserve to be fairly compensated, plain and simple. We thank Representative Censor Mira and the co-authors for seeing the need to rectify this. The question that we submit to you is, how can we work together, employing a culture of collaboration to ensure that this proposed base pay is feasible, tangible, and sustainable for all schools and districts in light of the present funding strain and obligations that our school must contend with? Our students cannot afford another educational divide. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. Please support House File 3119. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Roberson. Next up, Lori Goth, then Kristen Scott, and Brian McCarthy. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair, members, my name is Lori Goth, and I'm a special education para for St. Michael Albertville School District. I provide academic support in general education classrooms, and I run a resource room where students can come to get extra help when we don't have enough paras in each classroom. There was a time when education support professional jobs were sought after because of the good pay and great benefits. But after 25 years of underfunding by the state of Minnesota, our wages and benefits have not kept up, and positions like mine are actually hard to fill. I've been a para in STMA for 8 years, and I'm one of those who have been there the longest. In my first 5 years, I received a single 50-cent wage increase, and our step movement was frozen. Now I'm at the top of our pay scale with longevity, and I still make under $25 an hour. Students with disabilities cannot access their constitutional right to a public education without paraeducators. Our jobs are important, and our students deserve schools that are fully staffed with the best people. We have fought very hard in bargaining to bring up starting wages. They are now $21.15, but many people who interview and even have accepted the position end up not starting because they go elsewhere for better pay and better hours. The employer contribution to health insurance is based on our hours worked, so there's a lot of pressure to keep our hours low. Everywhere in the state, paras end up working off the clock because we need to get things done but can't go over our 32 and a half hours per week. I work multiple jobs, and I would make more money if I left education and increased my hours with any of my other employers. So if I was making a purely business decision, I would not have stayed in education. There are a number of people that think the benefits make up for the low wages, but that hasn't been true for a long time. When we're in bargaining, the district comes to the table, says, this is your budget, wages or health care. Not everyone takes the insurance, but everyone takes the wages. So we put more on wages, and the insurance gets more expensive, and the plans just get worse. After decades of disinvestment, my insurance is, well, bad. I'd like to tell you about my son. One day he woke up and couldn't see out of his right eye. After many appointments with many doctors and specialists, and patiently, also known as agonizingly, waiting for test results and numerous MRIs, we found out he has a rare eye disease. It took a year, but the doctors found a way to stabilize it. Unfortunately, our insurance will not cover the medication that the doctor prescribed. Instead, we are forced to use a medication that is for children with cancer who are waiting to have a bone marrow transplant. It suppresses the immune system and has possibly devastating, and irreversible long-term side effects. He needs to be on this for at least 3 years and possibly forever. This medication isn't covered by our insurance either, but it's $168 a month out of pocket rather than $7,000. I work three jobs just to pay our medical expenses, and my son may still lose his sight. Imagine telling your child that you can't afford to keep them healthy. I don't want to be just one more sad story, but I do want to put a face to a statewide problem. ESPs in every district in our state are struggling to care for our families. This is a statewide problem, and it needs a statewide solution. That's why a statewide minimum wage and statewide health insurance are so important. These would allow us to care for our kids at school and our families at home. I encourage you to support this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for sharing your story, and especially thank you for being a special education paraprofessional. Next up, I believe we have another paraprofessional. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Scott, and I'm a proud AFSCME member and a paraprofessional in the Elk River School District. Working in education is a calling. We surely aren't here to get rich. We're here because we love our kids. We take care of them every day, and we do this for far less than our equally educated counterparts in pretty much every other profession. My income after over 20 years of experience, and including a second job and sometimes a third, still barely meets cost of living standards for just me, for the counties that my school district serves. And the amount we pay in healthcare premiums and deductibles has continued to go up year after year much faster than our wages. The last renewal we had in my school district was 11% higher than the previous year. We received a modest increase in the district's contributions to our premiums in our recent two-year contract, and that was barely enough to cover it. It pretty much brought us back to where we started. And now in the second year of our contract, we're looking at another increase, which is essentially a pay cut. I sat this year on the insurance committee where we listened to a consultant who is paid five times my yearly salary explain to us how prices are going up for prescriptions and procedures, and we were going to need at least a 10% increase just to cover expected costs, plus more to increase our reserve. We talked about how many people in our plan are high-cost claimants, because if we have too many of them, it could affect our renewal. God forbid one of our coworkers or our own family member has an accident or a scary diagnosis. There's something wrong when someone who is going through one of the worst times in their life should feel bad for using the health insurance that they pay for. That's too much to ask for some of the lowest paid employees in the perpetually underpaid profession of education. What we're doing now is not sustainable. We need better pay and a more efficient, cost-effective health insurance system. When we work together, we have increased bargaining power with insurance companies and more stability for our families. If you want great outcomes for our kids, you need to ensure support for the people who are teaching them and caring for them every day. I ask for your support of House File 3119 as amended and the $25 minimum wage for education support professionals. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Final testifier, Brian McCarthy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian McCarthy. I am a geography teacher at Two Rivers High School in West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Eagan School District 197. I also serve as the Legislative Action Chair for Education Minnesota. I have a speech before me. I'm not one to read off a script very much, and the reality is I can't say and underscore the crisis that we face as eloquently as the folks that have spoken before me or as Representative Sensimura has framed earlier in our testimony. But I do want to talk, hopefully, because I think as I look around this room and I watched all of your faces this time, we have a lot of people that care a whole lot about our communities in this state. There's a crisis in this country of health insurance. It's national, it's statewide, it's local. We've heard about families having to make very difficult decisions. I serve on our labor management committee that is in charge of seeking those bids on insurance. I could go and tell you story after story very similar to the tragic, sad choices that folks have talked about today. And I also can get under the hood on the finances of this as well. The reality is that the bills in front of you provide us a pathway forward to create financial stability for our families and for our communities. This bill is bipartisan, and on behalf of our educators across this state, I thank all of you, Republican and Democrat, that have looked to author and co-author on this bill because you recognize that this is tearing away at the fabric of our state and our communities. It's also a bipartisan problem. And in a community like mine, where we have Democrat and Republican voters, where we have progressive and conservative families, health insurance costs are not political. Those things impact families across those political divides. And what gives me hope in such a challenging time politically is that this is an opportunity for all of you to make a difference in the lives of our community. To be able at the end of the session to go home and say, you know what, I worked across the aisle to make our families and our communities stronger. I understand that there are concerns from some of our partners in education. I've heard the testimony from the Minnesota School Board Association's AMSD. I've talked to superintendents. I've talked to these brokers. I understand their arguments. The reality, though, is that when you get under the hood of the House files that were in question and the Senate files accompanying them, is that there's a path forward. And this is the only viable path forward in front of you where we can actually make a difference and begin to make a difference in the lives, not only in educators, but the families that we serve. Because as so many people testified today, when we have educators that enter that classroom door every day to be able to make a difference in their lives, and they're free to do that work, our communities ultimately are who will bear that benefit. And so, ladies and gentlemen, today, I appreciate the opportunity that I've had to speak to you. I urge your support on both of these bills, and I really would like to ask you to think about how this can really make an impact in the lives of Minnesotans across this state, rural, metro, and urban. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Sensimura, we did get the handouts. Did you want to quick explain it, and then we can go to Mr. Strom to further?
And I actually don't have a copy of it.
So that would probably be helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. So, you know, one of the things that we are trying to address in this bill is just getting better data from our districts about what they are paying for health insurance. So I believe that this was what Mr. Strom was able to pull related to how districts are coding the health insurance and dental insurance costs, but maybe Mr. Strom can kind of go over what we know is included in this, and then as I understand it, there are things that the districts have told us are not included in this, and if you can try to speak to that as well. Thank you.
Mr. Strom.
Chair Joaquin, Representative Sensimura, you're correct. The starting place for the printout is from what we refer to in the accounting system as the object codes that school districts use for their accounting system. The object codes are essentially the most detailed level of expenditure for the service or commodity purchased. And three object codes relate to the district share, the employer share of payments for health-related objects. The one in the middle of the page labeled Object 220 is the health insurance premium costs paid by the school districts. You can see that districts for fiscal year 25 paid for their share of the cost $1.2 billion. If you move to the right, you can see the next column is Object 251. That's the object code for tax-advantaged health arrangements, which we often refer to as health savings accounts. And you can see the districts from the employer share paid another $111 million for those accounts. And then finally for dental, the code 235, districts paid roughly $49 million as the employer share of dental insurance plans. So if you look up and down the list for the 220 code, you can see the amounts that each of the districts paid, or their expenditures, as it were, for those categories. But one thing that's hard is how to compare the $1 million that Aiken paid to the $49 million that Minneapolis paid. So I've attempted to show that two different ways. First, dividing it by an enrollment count, just so that it's measurable, not because it's related to enrollment at all. And you can see the average per enrollee is $1,430. And you can look up and down the list to see how your districts rank compared to that. A second way to divide it is by the number of the number of staff for whom health insurance is available. Unfortunately, I have active teacher counts, I have active administrator counts, and a somewhat dated count of paraprofessionals. I have a full-time count, not a total count. And remember that the school district insurance plans usually include the retired teachers as well for those that stay on the plan. So the denominator here of the staff that we know about, the 84,000 staff, is not the complete staff. And this doesn't correlate to the amount that the school district pays per teacher or per para, but rather it's just another way to get us an average measure to compare across districts. So you can look up and down the list there. You see, again, about $1.23 billion for direct payment on the employer side, which is $1,430 per student, or $14,700 per the listed staff on this page. But that listed staff, as I just said, is too low, but we don't have data for the others. One final thing to say about the data is this is just the employer paid share, and the big unknown is what individual employees are paying across the state. The health plans vary, and the amounts that individual employees have bargained for their share also is variable across the state. And that's an area where there's no statewide data at this time as to the amount of those costs. Madam Chair, that's a quick summary of the printout that's in front of members.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Sensenbrenner, I believe we'll go to the table for questions. So far right now I have Representative Bennett and Representative Ray Bowers. So whoever else wants to talk, please raise your hand. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this has been very interesting to listen to. There's so many big issues here. I'm going to make a couple comments, and then I do have a question, Representative Sensenbrenner. But in regards to the health insurance, I think health insurance costs are huge, and I believe it's a broader picture than just education. And I hear from the teachers here, I hear those struggles, and I get emails, and I totally understand that. But I'm also hearing that from my small business owners and employees, from my local farmers. It's a huge issue, and it started 16 years ago with what was called the Affordable Care Act, which has really turned into the Unaffordable Care Act. And as a state, we have to look at this, and there are things we can do, waivers we can request as a state that are outside of this committee's jurisdiction. It needs to be addressed. We have to walk very carefully into whatever we choose to do, including what's mentioned in this bill. So I thank you for bringing forth the comments and lots of things to think about, but I think we have to be very careful how we fix these things and make sure we're doing it in the broader scale for our state. The second thing, talking about teacher pay, I'm a former teacher of 33 years, And believe it or not, when I started, it was $12,000 a year. That's pretty bad. And it got bumped up like $2,000 within not long for that. And it kept growing. But teachers, I'll just tell you, they've always been underpaid. I agree. And teachers should be treated as, or paid as professionals. But then they also should be treated as professionals, which is another big issue, because they're not often treated as professionals. And we need to look at that as a broader picture as well, and look at performance-based pay and things like that, which a lot of professionals get. Teachers deserve that too. So I think, again, a broader picture look at this as to what we do. Trying to see, I took a lot of notes because this was very interesting, Representative Sensenmira. A lot of good discussions. I don't believe more mandates are the answer here. We've seen what mandates are doing to our schools. They're sinking right now. I believe more flexible funding for our districts, reducing mandates, so districts can pay their teachers more and compete for teachers. We have, you know, our local rural schools are just crying out for teachers, and it's difficult. Of course, now they're in the point where they're having to cut teachers because they don't have enough money. And yet we have a $250 million special ed cut coming up with another $50 million suggested by our governor, and we have to balance that with pay increases for teachers. It's just, we're putting terrible pressures upon our local schools. And I believe we need to free up funding and give schools a lot more flexibility so that they can pay teachers what they are due as professionals. My question here, Representative Sensenmira, is because as I think through all the discussions we've had in this committee over quite a few years, I hear we have a lot of things that have come on school districts, mandates that are taking control away from our local school boards and local collective bargaining. And for example, the paid family leave, sick and safe time, all those things are no longer part of collective bargaining, really, because the state has taken that over. There's been talk of taking over class size through mandates. All the things that our local school boards do and our independent school districts. So I guess my question is, are we really, is our goal to create a statewide school board? Because it seems like we're trying to mandate so many things, and now we're trying to mandate minimum pay. And what will happen to collective bargaining? What will happen to our local school boards? What is our purpose? Is our goal here to have a statewide school board? And I guess that's my question.
Representative Sensenmira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Bennett. I think those are really good questions. And, you know, I think this bill is a work in progress. I think it's continued conversations. I think specifically around the health insurance piece, I do not think we are seeing that every local school district, 330 districts trying to bargain with the health insurance companies is working, right? This is not like no shade to our unions who are doing a great job with the bargaining, but each district alone cannot stand up to these health insurance companies. And so, you know, I know that the teacher health insurance pool idea is something that's been talked about at the legislature for many years. I think we're in a different place than we were 20 years ago with health insurance. I don't think we would have heard from teachers coming and saying, I'm paying, you know, up to $1,000 a month in premiums. I can't afford to have a family. I'm happy that I had a miscarriage in another country because at least it was paid for. I mean, the stories that we've heard today, I think we can all agree, are heartbreaking and absolutely not what we want to put on the people that do the important work of taking care of our kids. So I don't think the current system is working with the way that health insurance works, the way that we have the system currently set up in our country, which I think is a system many of us would like to change fundamentally, not just for teachers, but for small business owners and all the other people that you talked about. It is really us against the big health insurance companies. And the only way that we are going to gain power is by creating bigger pools. And when we are looking at a pool of about 100,000 people, I know that we will be able to get better results for both employees and their families. So I do think that's something that we should be doing at the state level rather than at the individual district level.
Thank you. Quick follow-up, and then I'm going to hand it over to Co-Chair Kreisha because I forgot to ask if anybody had questions on the graph.
Sorry, Madam Chair. And I'll just, I guess my question, Representative Sensenmira, wasn't so much directed toward the health insurance component as the minimum pay component, and my concerns that we are taking away local bargaining and the local authority of our elected school board members and putting it upon the state. So are we trying to create a statewide school board here.
Representative Sensenbrenner.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bennett. Again, I would not say we're trying to create a statewide school board. I think about it in a similar way to we talk a lot of the state about statewide minimum wage, right? This idea that we want to set a floor for what our teachers should be paid, starting with $60,000, no teacher in the state should be paid less than that. I think that's a really good floor. I think there could be a lot of collective bargaining on top of that, but this bill would set that floor, which I think is important.
Thank you. Co-Chair Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sensenbrenner. And the questions I'm going to have are just trying to understand the program we're going to put in front of us, make sure I hit some of the technical things. So I understand. So, and Representative Sensenbrenner, feel free to jump in. I'm going to turn to Mr. Strom first, but if you need to clarify. So the first thing is, as I read through this and I understand who we cover to some degree, but who doesn't this cover? I mean, there's lots of job categories in schools. Is this just a teachers and unlicensed? Who is not part of this? And I can go to either.
Who would like to answer that? Mr. Strom.
Chair Joachim, Chair Kreisha, the pool is in school districts is generally covering the full number of workers, often with a different contribution by members depending on the bargaining unit that they're in. But usually it's that full-time status or not that determines whether there's coverage of the full pool of what you'd think of as all of the people that are in the school. Ms. Pompu is with us today, and she can tell you specific information about what's required for a pool to cover or exclude some personnel. But generally speaking, what differs from district to district is the number of bargaining units that they have and then the agreements they have with their non-bargain employees for what shares they'll be paying, but not the pool itself.
Did you want to add?
I don't have any, sorry, Chair and members, I don't have any specific information on who else is in the pool outside of what Tim has mentioned.
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair Kreisha.
Thank you. And it's what I'm looking, I mean, because we have two parts of this, right? We have the insurance and then we have the wages that we're setting that. And as I said, we have lots of people, and Representative Sensenbrenner, maybe you can, are we covering all of them? Or I'm assuming some people are going to be left out of this and have to come back with future amendments to the program and all that. Is that, I'm just trying to get a sense of all the employees and people that participate in the school.
Yes.
Representative Sensenbrenner.
Yes, thank you, Chair Kreisha. So, you know, as I understand it, this is really trying to cover the broad swath of school employees. Anyone who is an employee of a school, so, you know, bus drivers, teachers, paraprofessionals, people who work in nutrition services. You know, I know that questions have come up around there are people who work at schools that are more kind of independent contractors. So let's say like a sports coach, yeah. I do not believe would be covered under this, but it is intended to cover the wide swath of people that, you know, interact daily with our students.
Okay.
Mr. Representative Sensenbrenner, and I'm assuming that if a school district doesn't own their own buses and contracting the contractor of the bus companies, they would be covering their own employees, but that was a good question. Co-Chair Kreisha.
Thank you. And then you don't have to answer this one, but, you know, one of the things that's kicking around in my head is, okay, so if a program like this goes in place, are we later modifying for, as you already mentioned, coaches, salary schedules around coaches and all that? So I'm not looking for an answer there. Those are just things that I'm thinking about as the functionality of this. Two other quick questions. Mr. Strom, so I see the numbers you have here. As this is in place now, or if this is how we would do it, the $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion, this would be additional aid, I'm assuming. It's not necessarily taking back what they're already doing. We're not doing an adjustment. So this would be aid on top. Is that how this is written now?
Chair Kreisha.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, thank you. Chair Kreisha, yes, the way that the amendment containing the portions of 2904 are currently is that the district would be receiving additional state aid above what they are currently paying for their insurance costs. So the $1.4 billion that shows up on this printout, again, depending on whether dental is included in that or not, you know, but the roughly amount there, essentially, it would be built on top of with the additional state aid. So that would be replacing, essentially, the employee portion of the policies. And then the policy, of course, would be a different price, perhaps. You know, as you heard, the larger pool may have benefits for many districts, may There may be some districts where the pool isn't the same as what they're currently getting. But essentially, the aid payments would be covering that other portion on top of this amount that districts are currently paying.
Co-Chair Crescia.
Okay, and thank you. And thank you, and Chair Akeem. So if I understand this, we'll just take school district number one, Aiken. So $1.1 million of aid would be on top of it. Then could I assume $1.1 million would stay in their general fund so they would be getting it on both sides?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, no, the 1.12 is what they're currently paying. So whatever their total cost is under EGIP, if that were $3 million, for example, the additional $2.8 million would come from state aid to them. Whatever the employer share is now stays there. The employee share comes added on top now through the state aid payment. And then in the language of 2904, it sets the percentages for a single plan and a family plan. So there'd still be the employer share or the employee share beyond that from the 85 and 95% that are listed in the bill. But the difference that would be essentially the employee share that's not being paid now. So the state aid is filling in the employee share up to those percentages that are in the bill.
Representative Sensenmura.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Crescia, for these questions. Yeah, just to direct people to where the contribution section is in the bill, so 8.12 in the A3 amendment, so 85% contribution of premiums for families, 95% for single premiums. So, you know, the intention, Chair Crescia, is that, you know, the districts are only getting, you know, an extra aid if the health insurance ends up being more than what they are paying now. And I would assume that through this, most employees will be getting more covered than they are currently getting from the health insurance plan that they are on. And I do think, you know, we don't have a fiscal note. We've kind of walked through all the information that we would need to be able to gather what a fiscal note would look like. But again, we are pooling more people together. I think we could anticipate that the health insurance costs broadly would go down because of that. And so there could be savings to offset the higher amount that we are asking the districts to pay for their employees' premium plans.
One co-chair. Okay, so now I think, so what we're doing is we're leaving the aid for the schools. They're still paying their employer side. We're paying down the employee side. Is that correct?
Am I hearing that wrong?
Anything on top of what they are currently paying. So if we are looking at, and Mr. Storm, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if we are looking at, you know, let's say Minneapolis is currently paying 51 million. If they ended up paying through this plan 52 million, we would give them $1 million.
Mr. Strom, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Sensenmura, yes, I think the scale is quite a bit different. The employee share is quite large in any of these districts, but yes, that's the way that the mechanism that would work. Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, Chair Crescia. Yeah, and Mr. Strom, I would assume too there's some districts that don't pay that large of a share. So they'd probably be getting more aid because the bill would require them to be paying more share than they're paying now.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Under the current funding mechanism in the bill, it starts with whatever the district is paying now, provides the additional aid on top of that to reach the 85 and 95% contribution levels. And, of course, as the witnesses testified, plans throughout the state vary dramatically with their experience rating and the amounts that the plan itself is costing, depending on the health of their employees and their retirees that are in the plan.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Next up, we have Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you to Representative Sensenmura for bringing this bill forward. My comments are going to be specific to the Educator Group Insurance Program, or EGIP, portion of the bill. When I started teaching in 1999 and when I was in college, you know, getting my teacher licensure, really the talk of the town was, you know, teachers don't make a great salary, but it's a great union job and the benefits make up for it. That is no longer the story today. I recently did a coffee morning listening session with our educators from Anoka Hennepin, which is the school district in my district, also the school district where both of my kids graduated from. And it was one of those mornings where you leave with a broken heart and you leave demoralized. And the stories included burnout. They included many folks that are considering leaving the profession, as we've heard echoed today by multiple testifiers. They shared how they have larger class sizes or larger caseloads than they've ever had in their career, less support, increased student behaviors. But they're dealing with all of that while also settling a contract after almost going into a strike where they now have less take-home pay than they had last year. Why? Their health insurance costs went up 22%. And yes, this is a problem across all stages, all walks of life, but we're in the Education Finance Committee, and we are the ones who finance our teachers and all of our educators. So it is our job to help figure this out. So Anoka Hennepin is not alone. It's all across the state. We've seen increases 10%. We've seen increases 30%. We've seen 40%. And when your salary take home is already low and the increase doesn't cover the cost of that increase in health insurance, you're actually making less money, not just an adjustment for inflation, but actual less dollars on your paycheck than the year before. Okay, so in addition to this, we made some great investment in education in 2023-2024, but in many districts, most of that was eaten up by the increase in costs of health insurance. So it really didn't help our educators and our students. But I do have hope. I have hope, and there is hope. There's hope for our educators, and there's hope for our students, because our students deserve the best educators they can have. And that's not what's happening right now. Half of our licensed teachers aren't teaching because they've left for better paying jobs with better benefits. So we're not getting the best of the best. We can turn this around, though. We, us as legislators, we get to pass laws that can change this. And I believe this EGIP bill will make a significant change for the better for financing public education. I want to say thank you to all the parents who testified today. It was heartbreaking, your stories. You shouldn't even have to be here doing that. But thank you, because we need to know what a crisis it is. And I'm committed, and I hope we're all committed as a legislator to make legislature to make a difference on this. So thank you.
Thank you. I've got Representative Mueller, then we're going to go to Representative Johnson after that.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. I have a...
Sorry. Okay, here we are.
We love how these tables are. I have two questions and just a comment. So my first question, I read through the report that Pelsby was talking about, and on page 14, they talked about how the teacher compensation for salaries, they strongly recommended for this to be phased in over, I think they said, 5 years. That is not reflected in this bill, and so I just wanted to ask why.
Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a great question, Representative Mueller. And I know that we have looked at different states who are, who have passed policies like this. I'm thinking about the bill that we've looked at in Maryland, where I think they did do a phase-in approach. I'm open to that, right? I mean, I think the reality is that we have teachers that are on the verge of leaving the classroom, and I want to do everything I can to keep them in. We have people that should be in our classroom because they could do good for our kids, and they're not going in there because of the salaries. So this is something I think we should have done yesterday. I think we should have done 10 years ago, but I'm certainly open to talking about a phased-in approach.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, having that discussion would probably be really important as we start looking how this would affect our districts. The other part of the report, when I was reading on page 28, they mentioned the examples of like Arkansas and Tennessee and other things. Well, when they did base pay for especially states like Arkansas, they coupled it with other policies like performance pay or getting rid of LIFO or some of those other things. So it's not just a strict... it's not a very strict comparison. Is that something was that something also in the works as we, or as in the discussion, as we start thinking about having mandated state pay like this?
Representative Sensenmiller.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mueller, for the question. You know, I think when we started digging into this, what we really saw that it needs to be paired with is the health insurance piece, right? Because what we actually saw was that districts are constantly going, or, you know, teachers are constantly going to the bargaining table and having to choose between wages and health insurance. And so we first thought, like, we have to do the both of these things together, because one district that has taken a huge pay cut to have better health insurance, and we have a district over here that has better health insurance but taken a huge pay cut, in, you know, kind of fairness between districts, that's why we needed to couple those. Certainly open to talks about how we have accountability for our teachers, right? I always think about how we need to pair accountability with resources, right? And we're not doing the resource piece right now. We are asking our teachers to move mountains with little pay and, you know, policies that actually, like, negatively impact their families. I think we need to do right by our teachers, but I think we need to ask them to do right by our kids, absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Quick follow-up, and then I've got about eight more people on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would say, you know, I'm with Representative Bennett and many of us in here, where we really love the idea of paying teachers more, especially if we can find a way to ensure the most effective teachers are awarded not only for their work, but just overall, we talk about the value of an effective teacher. I think that's really important. I love the idea of making health insurance more affordable for educators. No one, I've been a teacher for 20 years, and no one enters that profession with the goal of taking a vow of poverty. And my husband's a pastor. So it's one of those things where we understand what it means to have bills and have struggles. We get that, and it's really difficult for and listening to our stories today have been just very moving. The supporters of this bill need to understand, though, that if something like this happens, it is a big target for future governors like Governor Walz to come and cut. Because what the state provides, the state can also cut. We've already seen a $250 million cut in special education. We saw how Governor Walz has asked us to cut QCOMP. He's asked for another $50 million cuts. These cuts are only after a couple years after we made commitments to reduce cross-subsidies, and now Governor Walz wants to take that back. So let's have our eyes wide open with this, because we are finding out where our priorities are. If you work for MDE, you get a pay raise. If you work in the classroom, you get a pay cut. So my warning is this. If we manage to enact these programs, we need to make sure that we have our eyes wide open. Don't expect funding to last, because we're already seeing what happened with Governor Walz and his priorities in this budget, in this past budget, in the supplemental budget. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. Just a couple of things that really jumped out at me. One is the huge percentage of licensed educators are no longer in the classroom. I mean, in this committee, we talk, and in the workforce committee, we talk a lot about pipelines, we talk about apprenticeships, we talk about how we draw people in. But if we have no plan to keep them, what are we using? Why are we using those dollars to do that? This bill, with both the pay piece and the benefits piece, is a way to make these professions what they are, sustainable professions for the folks that choose to do it. I want to really heartfelt thank you to the testifiers that came and shared their stories. It obviously is not easy to talk about that struggle, but it highlights how broken that health insurance system is. And part of that is that instability and the fluctuations and the things, the ups and downs, and the consultants that say, well, you got to raise it 15, 20, 30% in order to keep this plan going. That stability that we talk about with a statewide requirement for everybody to be in it isn't just stability for the educators and their plans. It's stability for our school districts. They don't have to go out and search for and shop for the best deal, the best bang for the buck, what they can afford versus what their teachers need. And look at it just a little bit like our pension systems. I mean, when I got hired in my early 20s, if somebody would give me the choice, do you want to put money into your pension or do you want to get it in your paycheck, I might have made the wrong decision, because at that point I wasn't thinking 30, 40 years down the line. But our pension systems work because everybody's involved. That's how they stay stable and they do the work that those systems do. So if we look at it in that realm, this idea that requiring everybody to be in is not anything out of the ordinary. And I'll just close with this, that the fact, and one of the testifiers mentioned it, this is a calling, right? People choose this profession for all the right reasons. And just because we label something a calling is not an excuse to pay them less or give them worse benefits. We rely on these people for everything that we do, and I think we should need to start treating them that way. So thank you very much for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, looking at this, I was on the negotiating team for teachers' contracts, and one of the things I discovered is that we weren't competitive at the bottom because we always put an even percent to the, you know, steps and lanes. So what we had to do is we had to put half the money in equally across everybody, and then the other half was in by percent. And what I've seen from the formula is a lot of districts are now underwater in my area because everything's thrown into the formula. We need to increase that base, especially if you go to this fixed salary structure, because I know that we were paying much less than some of the districts where the teachers were taught before, but they came to our district because it worked well. I think the last time there were two in science, third in reading, and 12th in math. And I think they're at like 98.6% graduation rate. But they're also one of the bottom. In fact, I've got three school students from my district. Three of the schools that they go to are in the bottom 10 per pupil funded in the entire state. So that when you look at, here's the average, there's a big impact below. So you've got to maybe look at that discrepancy, because there are multiple districts where I live that have cut millions a year in their budget because they're underwater. And I think the rest of the story with this approach is going to have some really interesting impacts.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to Representative Sensenmira for this proposal, which should seem very common sense to pay our teachers a living wage, or I guess almost a living wage, you know, getting there and providing all educators with affordable health care, especially because they're making this choice, right, to essentially pursue a career that, you know, gives them a lifetime pay cut, right, otherwise, like, they could have gone to any other career. I just want to make sure that folks don't leave this hearing without understanding that, you know, the villain here is not mandates, right? It's the healthcare industry. Like I hear this from small business owners, from you know, large corporations to small ones. And so, like, Chair Bennett is correct. When your premiums increase, when your copays increase, it's not that the quality of your healthcare increases. It's that the CEOs make more money, or the shareholders make more money. And so I don't think we should punish educators and not provide them this option just because, you know, this is how lobbyists and corporations have set up healthcare in this country, right? If anything, I heard today an argument for universal healthcare, right? It's embarrassing that you know, we spend the most of other OECD countries on healthcare, but the quality of our healthcare is so much lower, right? And so we're clearly not getting our bang for our buck. So I just want to make sure that folks understand it's not because of President Obama. Like, he actually expanded healthcare access for everybody, right? You guys have heard my mom was an ASP, and growing up, we were never on my mom's healthcare plan because it was way too expensive. And that was way before Obama, right? This was like in the 90s. We knew that my dad's health plan was much more affordable for our family. So, you know, when we go to the doctor, people would, you know, ask, like, you know, who is this person, right? Like, my mom bringing us to see the doctor did not have the health insurance card with, you know, my dad's name on it, right? And so I knew that from a very early age that my mom would say, yeah, it was way too expensive for my kids to be my own healthcare plan.
She's still an ESP today and, you know, is barely making a living wage, right, after working for 30 years. But that's not to say that St. Paul Public Schools does not have good wages and benefits for teachers. And so this gets me to the other piece of this bill. The minimum floor for our teachers is really, really important. And, you know, it's common knowledge that St. Paul actually pays teachers, like, pretty well. And so a lot of people drive into St. Paul to teach our students. And so, you know, for people questioning whether you should support this bill, you know, I think for cities and places that don't have a big property tax base, this would actually allow, you know, folks in rural Minnesota to choose to stay there to teach the communities that they grow up in and not have to, you know, try to look for a school district that pays them a higher wage, right? And so we heard today, too, that benefits vary very widely against across districts across the state. And so I want folks to understand that, like, this allows teachers and their families to make the best decision for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think the wide variety of benefits is why we absolutely need to pass at least this year Section 16 of the A3, because it will help us collect the data. With that, members, I've got like 5 minutes left, so I want to go to Representative Clardy and then Representative Bakeberg. Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Rep. Senator Murrah. This was an easy bill to sign on. Teaching is a high-skilled profession, and teachers' pay affects outcome. Thank you for just looking at the floor of their income. I also wanted to bring up the piece with the ESPs. It's oftentimes we put a dollar amount on what they're getting paid, but we don't consider that there's times like vacation times that the regular teachers have where they do not get paid. And so I think that that was an important piece, as well as pulling in the national data to support the why of this bill. And then I just wanted to skip to the insurance, and this is for everyone at this table. As you know, I retired in January from my teaching position in St. Paul and was paying a lot for insurance. And I was really happy to get here to get the same insurance that we all have at this table, because it's a lot cheaper than what our teachers are paying for insurance. And we did have a fierce bargaining unit, so it had no, you know, no negative implications on that. On that, but the point is, it just makes so much sense to have it in a bigger bargaining pool to get the best rate for people. And if we're here to make sure that everyone here thrives, including our littlest ones, our students, we need to make sure that the people in front of them have the benefits. And just real quick, and I'm sure you, well, you know what, add this in your closing. I want to hear how this is going to affect your district and you as a mom with having highly qualified teachers paid well in your district. But you can save that for later. Thank you.
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Senator Murrah, for bringing the bill. I want to thank the testifiers as well, specifically Ms. Lawrence, for your testimony, and to the educators that came and testified, thanks for your service to our kids. So, and good luck with your future baby. So I think across the board, everyone in this room agrees that we need to support educators. We need to support our communities. Our schools in many of our communities are the hub of the community. It's a Friday night basketball game or football game or a play, a theater event, you know, Mr. Lawrence's concerts. People show up, and they show up because educators pour their heart and soul into kids. And So obviously we need to look at any way possible that we can support our educators. So just a couple quick questions, Representative Senator Murrah. Can you just make it very clear how this interacts with the local collective bargaining agreement that that individual districts negotiate?
Representative Senator Murrah, if you want to answer that, then you can go to your closing. Yeah.
Thank you. So as I see it, this is setting a floor for both wages and for health insurance. So for the health insurance, it is saying, you know, we are all part of the big pool. It is setting the minimum for what the district needs to provide for the premiums for both the individual and for the family. And then it is also setting a wage floor.
Perfect.
Representative Bankford.
Just real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the concern I have, to be very direct, is the sustainability of this. And one of our testifiers, I don't remember who it was, brought that up. And I'll just, for the sake of time, based off of the runs that Mr. Strom did, it looks like it's about a little over $1 billion for the health insurance side of it. And we don't have an estimate for the cost for the salary side of it. And, you know, we are the Education Finance Committee, and when we make decisions, we have to make sure that they stay in place long term. And just to be very clear to every one of the people in the room, we had a $430 million cut to education last year. So Governor Walz cut $430 million, $250 million from special ed. That came from the good work of addressing the cross-subsidy. That will come out of that. And in this year, he proposed another $50 million in a cut to cross-subsidy. That will result in less teachers, less money going out to our local schools to be able to support our kids, to be able to hire teachers. That is the truth. Salary, benefits, pensions, all of those things are important things that we should be addressing. The other piece that needs to be addressed at this legislature, not just this committee, is just respect.
I'd like the author to close, and we are laying this over, so you get one more minute.
Yep, so just respect for educators. And respect comes in a lot of forms and fashions. And simply put, let's trust our local educators. Let's provide them the funding, the flexibility, so they can negotiate their contracts. But we need to get back to respecting our educators. One of those ways is to help them maintain their classrooms as well.
Thank you. Representative Sensenmiller, would you like to close your bill?
Thank you so much to all the testifiers that came and spoke. I do really believe that your testimony moved people at this table, and thank you so much to committee members for really being really attentive listeners and really giving this huge issue a really robust discussion. So this bill is attempting to address two systems that I would say are really broken in this country. You know, the first is, what are the professions that we hold with esteem, and how do we show that esteem through what we're willing to pay, right? One of the things that stuck out to me from the teacher salary project was a statistic, I think it was about Finland, right, where they were saying Finland was trying to match teacher pay with accountant pay, and that was kind of the bar that they had set. I think to us in the U.S., that sounds, or at least to me, I'll say that sounded shocking, right, because that's really different than what we have done here, right, which has said, you know, I think accountant pay is probably twice as much as teacher pay here, and we would never think that that's like kind of the bar we should be setting for educators. You know, just as an example, in my own district, even if we're just comparing teachers to other public professions, a starting salary for one of the Minneapolis Police Department is twice as much as the starting educator pay. And so what does that say about what we as a society or we as a state are valuing? We need to be paying our educators more. We need to be paying everyone who is interacting with our kids a living wage. And then, you know, as we were working on the salary bill and the wage bill, we really started to realize that we could not untangle the wages from the health insurance piece, right? There was no way to equitably give people a pay raise if there were certain districts that had, you know, given a pay raise but had asked teachers to then make up for that raise by terrible health insurance. And we heard about families that are paying $1,000 premiums where they get a raise and then that raise is going toward their health insurance and more. So that's why we decided to bring in the health insurance piece. And I know I think we had a lot of evidence here today why we need to completely change the health insurance system for our entire country, not just teachers, but I think starting with a pool of 100,000 people here in Minnesota of public educators could certainly be a good first step in that direction. So thank you for the consideration for this important bill.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmiller, for bringing that forward. And with that, I will lay over House File 3119 as amended, and we will adjourn.